I'm Alex Green, and this is Stereo Embers, the podcast. Check this out.
Let me begin with a bedtime story. Let me remind you what you came here for. You can forget all the bygone glories. I can live up to them anymore. I thought I would try something new. I couldn't refuse this chance to redeem myself. I know that it's been a long time since these little rhymes were ringing your wedding bell. But now I'm like a blushing bride.
You're hearing Bedtime Story by my guest today on the program, David Mead. Let me tell you a little bit about David Mead. Okay, so for a lot of artists just starting out, they have to go through what I call the scruffy apprentice phase. And all that is a period of time where they're finding their voice and learning how to use it. And this happens over a lot of artistic mediums. For example, if you look at the comic strip Peanuts, in the early days, Snoopy looked nothing like Snoopy. He was long and thin and far more dog-like than he ended up being. Jack Kerouac's first novel, The Town and the City, had nothing in common with the ecstatic, spontaneous beat prose of his best-known later work, and take a listen to early R.E.M. live recordings. There was no enigmatic, poetic jangle to them at all. In fact, they were a jumpy new wave outfit that veered more towards rockabilly than alternative rock. My point is, even the greatest artists needed to figure it out before they hit their stride, and their early work has a ragged, rough-and-ready charm that only gets polished up after a few running starts. And then there's David Mead, who makes everything I just said sound completely wrong. There's not an ounce of scruff on Mead's 1999 debut album, The Luxury of Time. A shimmering pop song cycle, the album is as perfectly crafted as anything by Crowded House or Squeeze. Mead's divine falsetto and smooth pop croon made every track brim with majestic, melodic gold. It's as good of an example of out-of-the-box, ready-made perfection that I can think of. In other words, David Mead arrived, ready to go. And all I could wonder as I spun that record over and over and over again was, who is this guy? Well, all these years later, I have some answers. David Mead was born and raised all over the American South. His family moved around a lot because of his father's job as a salesman. Mead sang in the church choir and did school theater, but when he got his first guitar at age 13, everything changed. The young Mead grabbed that guitar and got to work immediately. He started writing his own songs, and by 16 he was gigging, and when high school was over, he moved to Nashville and played in the bands Blue Million and Joe, Mark's brother. In his early 20s, he moved to New York, signed a deal with RCA, and in 1999, that record I was talking about, The Luxury of Time, hit shelves. Now, it didn't hurt that Kenny Aronoff and the Mavericks' Paul Deacon played on the record, but Mead's elegant craftsmanship and polished pop chops had critics falling all over themselves with praise. And they kept falling. Mead's 2001 effort, Mine and Yours, was produced by Fountains of Wayne's Adam Schlesinger, and it too was a critically lauded disc. Now, I'm not sure if you're into numbers, but even if you aren't, consider these. For Mead's first two albums, he'd recorded 64 demos to choose from. I'm obviously no math expert, but those numbers tell us one thing. David Mead has no shortage of songs. Mead ended up leaving RCA, and his third album, Indiana, came out on Network in 2004, and it continued Mead's winning streak. The songs were catchy, economical, and lilting. In my opinion, it's a perfect record. And I'm not alone. Of the album's song Nashville, Taylor Swift once said, "I can't get it out of my head." Mead then put out the Wherever You Are EP, which was comprised of tracks intended to be on the original third album with RCA. Then he got married, and he cranked out the quirky and charming Tangerine album in 2006. Paste Magazine called it dazzling, but I went even further. I always go further than Paste Magazine. I called it astonishing. Well, we were both right. The album won Best Pop Rock honors at the 2006 Independent Music Awards. I was there, and I was seated next to the guys from Paste Magazine, and they went, "See, I told you so." And I went, "No, I told you so." It was that kind of a night. Anyway, back to our story. In 2008, Mead got divorced. He bailed on Brooklyn, settled again in Nashville, and put out the Almost and Always album. It was followed up by 2011's Dudes, and then, well, then that was it for a while. Mead got married again, he had two sons, and just kind of dadded around for a few years while he plotted his next move. And that next move is Cobra Pumps. A wicked platter of soulful pop, it's a dazzling return to form. From the tone-setting opener Bedtime Story to the soaring heights of The Business, Cobra Pumps is rife with catchy, melodic sting and harmonic perfection. Now, this is just a partial list, but over the course of his career, David Mead has toured with Joe Jackson, Liz Phair, and Ron Sexsmith. His songs have appeared in Private Practice, The Bold and the Beautiful, Van Wilder, and Ed. He plays in the Key West cover band Fanny Pack and the Nashville 80s cover band Guilty Pleasure. And his work has drawn praise from everyone from Mojo to Entertainment Weekly to Nylon. John Mayer once gushed, "David Mead is one of my favorite singer-songwriters." Well, he's one of my favorites too, and it was a pleasure to sit down and talk to him. So, this is my conversation with David Mead. Enjoy it right here on Stereo Embers, the podcast.
I don't even remember. I mean, the last time I was even physically in San Francisco was probably 2008, and that wasn't even for my own thing. I think. Oh, you know, actually, I went out and played someone's wedding there for at some point, maybe in the last 4 or 5 years. But as they were not technically there, but up at a vineyard somewhere. But you know, I drove by it anyway.
Yeah, must have been. Maybe I saw you in 2002 or 2000, and it was a packed show, totally sold out. And it was a great show.
Oh, great. Do you remember the other bands on the bill, maybe? I'm just curious.
Remember that.
Trying to think how many.
I saw your pal Matthew Ryan. I'd seen him a few months before at the same venue. And I can't even remember who opened there, but I don't remember. But I remember you crushed it.
Well, thank God. the alternative would have been disappointing for sure. So I'm glad you took that memory with you. I'm glad that was your impression. I've been sort of scouring the internet for just like random untapped content I could throw up on social media, and I've kind of had to plow through a certain amount of like what I would consider to be off moments, as the internet is so apt at preserving for you. And I needed to hear that, because I've just listened to about 15 versions of various things that were like, oh, right, that sounds like, let's see, if that was recorded there, then that probably means I was partying the night before in this city, and that's why that sounds like shit. So, yeah, it's all coming back.
Is there a lot of stuff that you're finding that you didn't even know existed?
Well, there is, and I'm remembering why I don't know it exists. It's just because it's sort of it sort of exists in the world of like you know, bad audio recordings or cell phone recordings or, you know, I don't really look for interviews or anything. I'm just sort of looking for, I mean, you know, social media, you have, you know, you have your craft and you have this thing that you've been working on and distilling for years. And you go to all these links to try to put it together and make it good and get it into the world. And it's like, and then you go to social media and you realize like, well, I need to mold this into some sort of thing that's going to basically compete with babies and cat videos because they rule social media. And it's like, okay, well, how do I come up with that version of what I do? So it's sort of like, you know, I guess I could dig up more literate, insightful moments that were captured over the years. And, you know, my suspicion is that most people just don't have the brain frequency to really get into that. You know, there's like three or four out there who might, but, I guess, sorry, it's a long way of answering your question to say, it's like, you're sort of looking for a particular kind of content. I found something that I had actually seen before, but had totally forgotten about, but I'm so excited about. There was an acapella group at a competition in Johannesburg that did an amazing acapella rendition of one of my songs, Girl on the Roof. And it's just fantastic. And I've never heard of or from these people. I have no idea why they took it upon themselves to do it, but I'm really excited about reposting that. I can't remember if I ever did or not, but it's great.
Do you find that with social media that you have to be kind of curating Instagram and Facebook on a constant, in a constant way, because otherwise people's attention span, they tend to forget you're there? Do you feel that kind of pressure?
I have before. And at this point, you know, I mean, I've basically just been dark on the internet in terms of like promoting myself for so long that it's all kind of gravy, really. You know what I mean? Like it's not, there's a analytical side to me that is a, you know, we'll sort of maybe, we'll definitely pay attention to numbers and stuff. And I find it easier to kind of stay in that world than to get into the, you know, it's dangerous, I think, when you make music, for example, to get into that. I guess they've isolated it as an actual physical reality, you know, these hits of serotonin that you have, you know, from little like dashes of approval that social media gives you. You know, I think it's so damaging to any kind of real creative process because it is real. It's absolutely true. So I generally tend to stay away from it. And because of that, I don't really understand how to work it. I just sort of have a broad look of like, hey, you know, I know my people are out there and I need to kind of gather them for this event. And then I will present this thing to them. And if it resonates with them, then hopefully they will tell people about it. And, but I mean, I kind of look at it as like isolating, to be honest. It doesn't really matter unless they're having their own conversations about it. You know, it's like I can, as you know, you see a bazillion people doing, I can stay on it forever and keep tooting my own horn, but it's just like, how many times can I tell you that this is available and I think it's worth your attention? It's like, okay, after a certain juncture, I mean, I've obviously made my point, so it's kind of up to you. And beyond that, I'm just another person out there, you know, pushing their product. So I don't know if that completely answers your question. Like when I started doing this, which was pre-social media, I mean, almost, not technically pre-internet, but definitely pre-broadband internet, let's put it that way. So it's like people's level of engagement. It was like you did have a feeling that you could very much kind of control the narrative. And, you know, at this point, we're like, I don't know, like 20 years past that being, well, maybe not 20 years, 16, 17 years past that even being a possibility. So I guess you can only care so much. It's like you can do all this stuff to, you know, present what you think is the acceptable picture of you. And then, you know, those crappy cell phone videos from some shitty night in Pittsburgh are still out there, just as available as, you know, the photo shoot that you spent $1,000 on. So I don't know. Does it matter at this point? It's kind of like, I guess it's comforting in a sense. It still comes down to, like, is someone just going to hear this song and like it so much that none of that shit matters? And that's what I'm hoping will happen.
Yeah, that's the hope. I mean, that is the hope. And were you dark on social media by choice, or in other words, what was the shift?
Well, I don't like engaging with people that way. It's not my, you know, I'm definitely the sort of person that, like, if I go to a party, I will find you and hopefully pin you down to have a 25-minute conversation that's uninterrupted, as opposed to hopping around and having, you know, minute and a half meet and greets with everybody. I'm terrible at the latter. I much prefer, you know, actually having some kind of long extended conversation and observing your body language and asking you why you're wearing that shirt. And, you know, that's just my comfort zone. And I'm not saying one is better than the other, but social media generally strikes me as like you just miss all of that. You know, you miss the, what is so much of the human experience, honestly, because, you know, going back to your word curated, it's like everyone is branding themselves and everyone is presenting their best curated version of themselves. And most people, myself included, are terrible judges of what that actually is, you know? Like, I mean, take it to the furthest extreme, say a marriage, you know? It's like, at this point, I've been with my wife for 8 or 9 years and we've known each other for almost 20. And, you know, it's like so many of the reasons I'm in love with her and so many things I find the most attractive about her are things I don't think she would ever intentionally present. You know, their little quirks, their little physical imperfections, their little, you know, ways that she uses syntax that I don't think that's probably something that she would, you know, put out as an advertisement for herself. But they're endearing. They make her real. They make her human. I feel like social media tends to strip a lot of that out of the experience of interacting. I mean, people end up kind of showing their ass anyway, but it always seems to be in some like way that's just completely unattractive, like some really weird, crazy overreaction to something they've taken incredibly personally that they would never do in person. You know what I mean? But the fact that they, I'll say we, because I've done it as well, are sitting at a computer by ourselves, we've like somehow feel this weird liberation to do that. So, yeah, it is. It was a choice, and it will probably continue to be a choice. You know, like I feel, have a conversation about this particular thing, this new record with them, and but like you said, it's sort of a limited conversation. It's like, here it is. I really hope you like it. And if you say things every once in a while that make me, that resonate with me and I want to respond to, then I'm going to respond to them honestly. But I feel very inauthentic kind of trying to present this, you know, rah-rah thing like life. My life is exciting 24/7 and I want you to share it with me. You know, my life is not exciting 24/7. My life is not very much different than anybody else's. I just did this thing that I think you might enjoy. I think you might be able to have your own experience with. So I'd like you to take it away and have that experience. But I'm not really an entertainer on the level that is going to allow you, or it's going to give you like some sort of personally generated experience all the time. Although, you know, it is like a form that kind of allows you to just do some weird ass shit and throw it up there and see what happens, which I kind of like that. But I don't really know that that is the sort of thing that, you know, strategically generates momentum or whatever. I don't really know what works, but, you know, here we are. Let's just like jack it up for a while and see what happens and then move on to the next thing.
in these glimpses now of social media, when the things that you do, it's like people get a, you know, people get a chance to sort of see like, oh, that's where he lives. That's the car he drives. That might be his cat. People get glimpses of your life that they didn't used to get. And I wonder if sometimes if it's too much. I wonder if that feels – not that it feels unsafe, but that it feels like, you know, you're peeling back the curtain of Oz, you know, and people are seeing like, hey, that looks like David Mead's kitchen. That's probably where he is, probably where he eats breakfast. I wonder if for a performer if that – the illusion of – because there's something Noel Gallagher said years ago where he said that people don't want to look up at the stage and see themselves. They want to see like a god. They want to see Robert Plant. They want to see someone that they can't necessarily be. That's that rock and roll experience of Freddie Mercury is like otherworldly. You know, David Lee Roth is like from a different planet. He's nothing like me. But with social media, it's like, oh, that's right. David Mead probably eats three times a day, and he probably has to feed his cat and take it to the vet. In other words, there's a kind of like level of domesticity which gets revealed through this sort of social media outlet that didn't used to be there. And I wonder as a performer how you feel about giving those little glimpses. It's the longest question in the world, but I wonder how you feel about giving those glimpses away to people, or if that bothers you at all.
Well, I guess when you frame it like as a performer, I you know, it's more as a fan in some respects that it bothers me, because I like, I might extend Noel Gallagher's summation a little bit, but it's almost like, yes, I always wanted to look up and see like a god on stage, but also like maybe a glimpse of, you know, possible god-like qualities within myself. Like I wanted to feel that connection and be like, you know, I know this guy's a human being. Like I could achieve that level of transcendence in whatever I do. I mean, for me, it was like, well, Lee, I literally want to be a musician like this guy. But, you know, for it could be, I think that's the, you know, that's the juju that gets generated by people operating at the height of their abilities. You know, it's just a very attractive energy. But there's a mythology around that, too, because what's happening there is I, as a fan, am injecting myself into the experience. I'm engaging with it because there's so much excitement and imagination that is triggered, that suddenly that experience becomes much more dear to me because it's much more personal. So what happens with social media to me that's different than – how old are you, Alex?
I'm 48.
If you don't mind me asking.
No, it's fine. I'm 48. I think I'm a few years older than you, right?
Yeah, I'm 45. So, okay. You know, when you and I were growing up, I'm sure we had very similar experiences. Like I walked a mile and a half to the Sam Goody's and I bought the record I wanted and I opened it as soon as I walked out of the store, and I spent the mile and a half walking home reading every lyric note and our lyric and liner note, and then I just sat in front of a, you know, hi-fi system listening to that record for 3 hours and doing nothing else, just staring at the artwork. And you know, so it's like we had these sort of like long drawn out meditative experiences in which we kind of communed with music on this level that required us to like mentally, spiritually, like get into it and to draw, you know, like make up our own stories about it. So it's like, instead of say seeing what Bono's kitchen looked like in two or three clicks of a button, it might occur to me to just make it up in my head, which meant that my experience with the music was so much deeper. So, I mean, you know, that's a summation, because I can't really speak to anyone's experience who does not share mine, obviously, but it stands to reason, you know, whereas it's like when I can just find that picture on social media and the question is immediately answered for me, then, oh, okay, well, that's one level less of engagement that I actually have with the music. And that to me is the sad thing about it. That's what I wish I could, you know, somehow get across to everyone is that if the tools at your disposal were fewer, if you would allow yourself to get more invested in this, then your experience would be richer. I guarantee it. And I think you used the word you did, domesticity, that sort of normality that social media kind of, it's like this weird thing, you know, social media, like going back to what I was saying earlier, it's like it makes civilians feel like they need to be entertainers, and it makes entertainers feel like they need to be civilians, when in reality it seems like the natural order of things was a lot more entertaining when it was still in place, you know. I hope that doesn't mean that I don't mean that to sound elitist as much as, like, there are some people who, like, when I say entertainers, I don't even necessarily include myself in that, because I don't feel like I have that gene so much as like a Lady Gaga or something. But it's like, look, those people have a gift of like they do that thing that you're talking about. Noel Gallagher does that thing that you're talking about. Like they take us out of our everyday. And it's like, suddenly when they're live streaming their life 15 hours a day, it's like, yeah, well, they're just kind of this person, and I don't even understand how that connects to the music anymore. I mean, I find it confusing. So I guess I feel a little disingenuous replicating that for people that I feel like my music. You know what I mean? I just kind of want to, I want to respect the work that I just did by giving it opportunity to kind of get into their lives. So I'll participate. And also, yeah, I think there always has to be a lot of gratitude with it too. You know, like, people, I think it's important for me to express and for people to understand that I'm really grateful that they have taken a chance on me and that they support me. Then furthermore, that they're, and most importantly, that they're going to, I guess, take a chance on the music, and that process kind of continues. I like that about social media. I like that you have the chance to personally engage with people for that reason, you know, because that's something that I think did used to get lost. And I think there's something to that. I always say, like, when gratitude is expressed, there's an energy that happens that's important. And I like the fact that rock stars, again, not claiming to be one, but I'm just saying that they can't necessarily get away with the asshole pose anymore, you know? I think that's nice.
It's true. And there's also, like, I remember my junior year of high school, I got a copy of Skylarking, and I listened to it, and it was spring here in California, and it's a very spring album, and there were no pictures of the band on the record, and it was just this weird, fevered spring world of mystery and strangeness. And I remember sort of my imagination about who those guys were and what the sort of circumstances were in terms of how those songs came to be made me more creative in my, you know, the rock and roll fantasy. I was filling in the blanks of who I thought XTC were. I may have been totally wrong. And so there's a little bit, I like the mystery of that, because it sort of makes you think, because you were saying you would stare at album covers. I remember, you know, I would get albums by, like, you know, the band Felt or Robin Hitchcock, and I would sort of start thinking about, like, who are these people? Because there wasn't a lot to go on. And so
absolutely,
you sort of, right? So you kind of create this illusion about, I think I even did it with you with your first two records, because I was like, where'd this guy come from? Who's this? Because I didn't know a lot about you. And I think I sort of created, you know, even at 35 or something, this sort of myth about who you actually were, probably because, you know, I didn't know. And social media kind of, what it does, it kind of melts away the myths. So you don't really do any of that sort of fantasy in your brain. I don't know if that's good or bad.
I just one more thing I thought about. I have a 6-year-old who goes to a Waldorf school. And I don't know if you have kids or if you're familiar with that methodology at all, but it's all very, like, you know, all the toys are wooden, for one thing. None of the dolls have faces. There are no colors. It's all just like this very kind of like organic experiential is not the word I'm looking for. The word that has to do with touch.
Oh, like tactile.
Thank you very much. That's the tactile experience of it. And the idea is like, look, we don't want to have toys here that really perform any advanced functions for kids. We want them to inject their own imagination into the experience. We want them, we don't want them coloring color. We don't want them using colors to color pre-drawn coloring books. You know, we want them to draw that from scratch, because it's like everything about the educational experience is inviting the children in. It's inviting their imagination to blossom. So that's a kind of a tried and true educational method that's for early childhood education. And to me, there's such a parallel between what listening to music used to be and what it is now. You know, now it's like the Buzz Lightyear that says 15 different voice prompts and, you know, flies and shoots 4 different projectiles, which I love Buzz Lightyear. So I hate to use Buzz Lightyear as the example, but it's that as opposed to like, you know, some plain wooden figure that you just kind of have to sit there and completely make up a story about. And I had that exact same experience with Skylarking. It's funny you say that. I think I had the cassette first, and I do feel like that picture of them dressed up as, I don't know what they are, like 18th, 19th century monks or something. Do you remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
it's like this picture of them with no instruments. They're just dressed in these hilarious costumes, just looking at the camera. And you're like, what the fuck is this? And you're right. I mean, God almighty, I invested so much energy into creating the whole, because, yeah, there was no press about that record. I mean, there was if you knew where to dig it up. But when it came out, I didn't know how to find CMJ or whoever was writing about it. It was like, you know, it just wasn't there. So it was like, yeah, it was completely, you got to make up your own story about that. And, like, what an amazing record to, I mean, that's the kind of thing where it's like you start to realize that there are all these, like as a young musician or a young music fan, even it's like, it's almost like as a young writer, you know, people will tell you, if you really want to have emotional impact, for example, then you need to come up with some very strong visual details in your scene that are things that people can like hang the experience on emotionally. They're like little punctuation marks, visual punctuation marks that really help your cause, so to speak. And I started to hear music that way, and that record was such an example of that. You know, it's like, oh, that's why having that little run or that kind of harmony or whatever, like that brings out an emotion, and that makes me feel something that I want to pass on or replicate. And I'm so thankful that I started listening to music at that point in history, because that was the kind of relationship I was having with it. I mean, that was in the 80s or in the 80s. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, people are like, why don't we have any Beethovens or Mozarts anymore? And it's like, well, think about what other stimulation those people had to get in there to distract them. I mean, compared to what we even had in the 80s, it's like they would walk around a nicely manicured garden and listen to birds. Like they had the amount of brain that those guys had to concentrate on what they were attempting to accomplish just must have been infinite compared to what modern life leaves us. But anyway, sorry, that's getting way out there.
I got my head on straight in a car by the 7-Eleven. Well, there was no one to blame. There was no warning light. See, I was only a boy wearing a raggedy coat of my father's. Yeah, I was only a boy.
I guess here's the way I treat it. You know, it's the way that I think of music right now. I'm past the point of feeling like it's something that I create as much as it's something that I get to participate in. I studied one of the things I did in my absence from making solo records was I took jazz piano for about a year, and I just kind of wanted to do something different that I felt like would sort of open my brain up, and it was a great move, actually. It really did that on a lot of levels. But you know, what you realize really quickly when you start really hunkering down and attempting to woodshed is one, if you ever want to be a great pianist, you should really start by the time you're five. And two, just like you submit to the process. You submit to the process of just playing scales. You just have to do it over. You have to just have that stuff muscle. You have to have so much muscle memory. You have to have it under your fingers, as they say. There's just this whole process, and it really heightened my respect for just music as something that exists before you and will exist after you. And it's like the best, and it's this whole relationship, which I think begins with experiences like we've just been talking about. It's this whole relationship and process that's happening in your subconscious that is yours, but it's also a communal thing, you know, and you just have to submit to that experience. Like, do not think you're in control of it. Just try to get as deep into it as you can. And again, like, participate, don't. And that is my goal with music. Like, that is my goal for the next 45 years of my life. Like, I just want to try to get as far into that experience as possible. So going back to like that person of David Mead, it has taken on a lot less importance, you know. If there's like a, I don't know, like an avatar or something, when I think of myself now, I try to put myself in situations where I'm like having an experience similar to like what I see my sons having, you know, the 6-year-old and the 2-year-old, just with everyday life. Like, there's just this enthusiasm and this verve and this attention to detail that just seems so minute to me, but there's an enthusiasm that comes with the newness of it. And that's kind of how I guess I view myself. I don't really, as much as I can, I'm trying to do stuff that I'm not as comfortable with, but is also effortless in a way, just because there's a desire behind it, which is I think is what I was, maybe not intentionally, but I feel like that's what happened on my new album that, you know, it's, for example, it's crafted very much around the electric guitar, which even though I played guitar for decades, I didn't really like fall in love on that super geek level with the electric guitar until probably like the last 3 or 4 years. And so I'm still an amateur in some respects with that instrument, and I still have that excitement and that fear and that respect and awe for it, and for all the, you know, bazillion people who have gone before me and are currently active and who are also participating in that instrument and who are, you know, trying to find a voice with it and who are, you know, just trying to do something with it, trying to play with it, because it is just play, you know? And so I don't know. I hope that's what comes across with anything I'm trying to present. I think I understand where Justin Curry is coming from when he says it's a character. It is sort of a role, because it's in the sense that it's something you get to step into, which is hopefully larger and more exaggerated. Okay, here, I'll tell you what the goal is. I'm not going to pretend that I achieve this every time, but it's like you want to tap in. It's like you have this kind of construct of like a performer and an audience. An audience is there for a reason, and if you've put yourself on the stage, let's assume that you think you have, this is going to sound so like magical thinking, but it's really like conduit. You want to just kind of be a vessel that something goes through. So, you don't want to do anything to get in the way of that if possible. And, so in some respects, I find it better if I can think about what we're talking about as little as possible. And just play the music and respond to the music, you know, because it's different every night, or, you know, every situation is different. You know, it's like I had some really good shows in like conference rooms while people were eating pizza under fluorescent light. And I've had some great shows like at the Ryman Auditorium. But it's just kind of all about like, well, what is this moment and what's it going to be? And just, you know, try to stay off script, because that's usually when interesting shit happens. So when you talk about a character, to me, a character is someone like you have to be the same guy every time you get up there. And I'm not really interested in that. Like sometimes I do a show and everybody knows who I am. And sometimes I do a show and no one knows who I am. It's like, you're two very different people. So kind of like serving two different purposes potentially. But if you go into it every time thinking like, well, everyone should know who I am. And look, I've been that guy. I've done that tour before and just resented it when people didn't. And that is just me, or was just me, getting in the way of someone else's experience, which is the last thing you should be doing as a performer and the last thing that someone should be paying money to see. So, I don't know. I think I like that whole, Eckhart Tolle. I'm sure he's not the only person who's thrown this out before, but there's this idea about identity. Like you're better off just being whatever the moment kind of requires. And I really like that. It's just like, look, you know, and some days, my day gig is being a property manager. You know, some days I'm the guy that goes over and removes and cleans shit out of your toilet when it's plugged up. And then some nights I'm the guy who goes and plays music. And it's sort of like, if I just decide to be one of those guys all the time, then the guy who just cleans shit out of the toilet is absolutely miserable. But you know what I mean? If I can allow myself to just be like, wow, this is kind of what this moment requires. So I'm just going to, find the beauty in this and get on with it. It's like my life is a lot more enjoyable. And I feel like, I don't know, I'm just kind of like tapped into a flow a little bit more that makes sense.
It's funny because I remember hearing that when John Fogerty's Centerfield record came out, when he was recording it, they would do a song and then he would take it out to his truck and drive around with it. And that's how he gauged if it sounded good.
Man, if he approves of that method, then that makes me feel much better.
Yeah, that method seemed to work. So, it's funny because I always talk about this guy because I think I'm so obsessed with what happened to him. But Lee Mavers of the Laws, I mean, he basically left music because he couldn't record what he wanted to hear. No, I'm sorry. He couldn't record what he was hearing in his head. And so to hear you say that with Cobra Pumps, it's on the nose. It's what you wanted and it came out the way you wanted. It's so refreshing to hear that artistically.
Well, good. I also just sort of accepted up front that, you know, it could have been a lot of different things potentially. It could have been there were a few different ways to probably do it and maybe to have equally as successful results. You know what I mean? Like there's sort of like that theory of like there's one and only there's the one and only person in your life that's going to make you happy, and I don't believe that and never have. Just because I think you could probably make it work with a few different people if you're open to making it work.
Right.
And that's how I think you should probably approach record making. Like, just get, like, just say, hey, there's not some absolutely perfect way to do this. It's just going to be like, see what happens, and just, you know, stick with it and kind of continue to be in the moment with it if you can. And what ends up is not going to be exactly what you expected to happen regardless. But this one, I was actually kind of shocked close to come out to what I thought it might be.
It's interesting how, in terms of artistic development, when you compare yourself now to, you know, where you were 30 years ago, because you were writing really fully realized pop songs. Do you think of yourself as a songwriter? Do you think that you've become better at it, or is it something that we're always sort of chasing that perfection?
Throw this out with the caveat that I live in Nashville, and the word songwriter is kind of a different, it means something slightly differently if you come from Nashville, because there's an entire industry of people who are professional songwriters, as there are in LA and New York. But it's not like it's a dirty word to me anymore, but I try to think of it more as like, well, there's a length of music that I seem to excel at, which is usually between 2.5 and 4 minutes. I seem to be able to come up with enough interesting material and arrange it in a way that is gratifying for them. There's so many people just writing songs, I would like to try to start approaching, you know, try to start thinking of it differently. Like, number one, you need a groove. Number two, you need a good melody. And then you need a harmonic interplay around that melody that keeps things interesting. And then you need a very simple idea lyrically that you can sort of kick around in, hopefully in more subconsciously generated ways than consciously. Because I think for a long time I was very obsessed with the idea of being like a literate, clever songwriter, and that's, I kind of rode that pony as far as I could. You know, it's more like at this point I'm just sort of interested in like creating like an emotional and spiritual response from people in the most efficient way that I can. So I know that sounds like I'm just really overcomplicating a very simple question, but it is honestly like how I think about it. Like I can't even sit down and be like, oh, let's write a song. You know, it's like, well, let's, I don't know. And somehow I kind of get back to the point where, you know, they just sound like I just sat down and wrote songs. Like, I'm aware of that, but I'm trying to at least like, you know, frame it for myself differently. So I think that's advancement. That's an evolution. You know, maybe it'll get to a point. I hope it gets to a point where it's better than it is. I think in order to keep it fresh, we kind of have to kind of keep changing the architecture of it a little bit and moving things around. And, you know, I think the lyric that I'm the most proud of, and I didn't realize this until about a month ago, but on this record, is that song, "She Walks Like a Grown Woman." And the I didn't even think about this, but like it just all came out as feel more. It's really about the way the words felt. And I tweaked the content a little bit at some point, but like, love of my life, a woman historic, is not a delicate thing. She's not a flower you crush in a frame. You'll never control her. She's going to do what she wants. You better give her some room. That's the lyric of the first verse. And I was like, I love none of that rhymes. It's just like, it's just sort of a list of modifiers, you know, like, and but none of it rhymes. It just feels right. It feel, and it's like, that's the coolest verse I think I've ever written. You know what I mean? Because it's like, for those reasons. I mean, not just because it doesn't rhyme, but just because it does. Like, why does that sound good to me? I don't even know. But that's the kind of thing I want to keep going after. I want to see, like, well, can that get refined? Can that get carved up more? That's interesting to me. So
yeah, and that's an early contender for me for one of my favorite songs on the album. But I know what you mean, and it sort of brings up this kind of world of possibility of, well, now maybe artistically and lyrically I can go a totally different direction.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is so cool. And you know, it's funny because one of my favorite songs of all time by anybody is Ordinary Life. And I start, because to me it's sort of like, it just sums up perfectly how that sort of, you know, the mainstream world, the quotidian world, feels foreign to somebody. When you decided to be, you know, an artist, to live an artistic life, and you sort of decided not to live a conventional life, do you know when that was, where you kind of went, I'm all in with being an artist? And did that ever scare you? Like, oh, I should go back to school and be a psychologist. Did you ever have doubts about that decision?
I still doubt it, because it does not afford me certain logistical, I don't know, like practicalities that I require, such as money. So yeah, I did go all in. I went to a college preparatory high school and never went to college. My options are limited as to what I can do. And then, you know, I'm so, in a lot of ways, far and away, more skilled at this particular thing, for which I'm not sure that there's a marketplace anymore than anything else. So, I'm asking myself that question at least once a week. I mean, not on a super deep level. Like, I know that I think I'd spend my life, most of it, doing what I'm supposed to be doing. But again, you know, it goes back to that identity thing. Like, I think it's good to keep asking yourself that question, because it's like, well, it's a privilege, and you do have to earn it. There's nothing more annoying than, you know, listening to like an artist who doesn't really do anything and hasn't really done anything for a while talk about art. You know what I mean? Anytime you get that conversation just gets so dry and academic, and it's just kind of irrelevant. So it's like, if you're working, if you've got something, then I want to hear about that process. But whether or not, I mean, I don't know. So I guess like it's an active process. You know what I mean? It's not a job title or a nameplate that you get at some point. It's like, are you doing it or not? Are you producing art? Then you get to be called that. But in a lot of ways, it's just a mindset, and it's a way that you approach the world. Whether you're deciding the best route to get to a restaurant, or the best way to construct a conversation as you're having it, or, you know, it's just that. So it's kind of moment to moment. And in the same respect, I still ask myself, like, whether or not trying to pursue a living off of that is something I should be doing or not, you know. Never stops.
You know, I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time, so I'm really glad we did this. This is great.
Me too. It feels like it was the right thing to do. I'm honored and flattered, and yeah, I mean, I checked out the podcast, and I'm honored to be among that company. You're obviously someone who knows what the hell they're talking about, and I'm glad that it's cool that we've had some shit experiences with some specific records and ways of ingesting them. So I'm glad we got to share that.
Sweet guy, that David Mead. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. I certainly did, and I know you'll enjoy his album. Go buy Cobra Pumps. It's phenomenal.
one of the year's very best. You can find all David Mead information at davidmead.com. All information about me, alexgreenonline.com. If you want to follow me on Instagram, please do so. Embers Podcast on Twitter, at Embers Editor, Stereo Embers. The podcast can also be found on Spotify, Google Play, and Stitcher. And hey, let's just say you're hanging around the iTunes neighborhood looking for something to do. Well, why don't you subscribe to the podcast? Just hit that subscribe button and iTunes does the rest. And if you wouldn't mind giving the podcast a rating, maybe a couple of comments with a few adjectives thrown in here and there, you know what I'm talking about. We would appreciate it. Also, if you want to email me, please do it. editor@stereoembersmagazine.com. Maybe there's a guest you want me to talk to, or maybe someone you want me to have back on the show. I can do that. Doesn't matter who it is, I can find anybody. I didn't mean for that to sound so creepy, but let's face it, that's a sentence that sounds creepy no matter how you say it. All right, let's close things off with a new one from David Mead's Cobra Pumps record. This is The Business. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time right here on Stereo Embers, the podcast.